Hello, welcome to Ruby Rogues, the Ruby podcast, sometimes involving Rails. Here on our panel today, we have the illustrious John Epperson.
Hello, everybody.
The outrageous Valentino Stoll.
Whoa!
And our guest speaker this week is Mylap Newpenny. Mylap, you're here to talk about AWS testing. No, Apache testing. I got confused. You're a senior engineer that doesn't just do Ruby, you also branch out doing Golang, is that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
If you'd like to, please introduce yourself because I'm doing such a bad job of it.
Thank you for inviting me to the podcast. So I'm, as you said, like I'm a senior software engineer. I work with Ruby on Rails and also with Golang. I have been recently working mostly with Golang and basically REST, I work with AWS technologies and certain infrastructure, I mean, cloud formation, infrastructure as code. Yeah, and also I organize a meetup here at Kathmandu of Golang, Golang meetups. And sometimes I give talk as a speaker, but I haven't done it recently due to pandemic. That's this introduction of me.
Did you work your tail off to get that senior developer gig just to realize that senior dev doesn't actually mean dream job? I've been there too. My first senior developer job was at a place where all of our triumphs were the bosses and all the failures were ours. The second one was a great place to continue to learn and grow, only for it to go under due to poor management. And now I get job offers from great places to work all the time. Not only that, but the last job interview I actually sat in was a discussion about how much my podcast had helped the people interviewing me. If you're looking for a way to get into your dream job, then join our Dev Heroes Accelerator. Not only will we help you get the kind of exposure that makes you attractive to your dream employer, but you'll be able to ask them for top dollar as well. Check it out at devheroesaccelerator.com.
Thank you. Now, we're talking today about load testing. Specifically load testing your Rails apps. Now, what we're not talking about is using these load testing tools to DDoS your friends' websites, because that's very naughty and we definitely should not do it. No using load testing to knock your friends' sites offline. So there must be a legitimate use for load testing tools, wasn't there? So why are you load testing your Rails app in the first place? Surely Rails is really fast. We know how fast Rails is, right?
Yeah, so Rails is like super easy to code and set up and things, but sometimes like it can go wrong when you are writing code and you forget about optimizing some of code and you have like heavy database query going on or some network calls, external network calls that's slowing you down. So these kind of things can be figured out during development phase, during testing your performance of your application, but at times, like usually when you ship the feature in production, there are a lot of users who are using your application, which you need to like verify what happens when your application is being used by 1,000 users, or what happens when your application is being used by 10,000 or a million. What happens, like, does the app platform perform the same way, or would your load balancer or would your auto scaling fail at that point? So figuring out those points in production when like you have some critical thing going on, like let's say it's a Good Friday, mm-hmm. like Friday sale and sale going on and your app goes down and you would not be able to know, like it would be very difficult for you to debug at that moment in production. So if you could be prepared prior to that, that would be like very good use case of load testing.
I'm a little bit out of date on load testing. The last big launch I did for a site was kind of a 2015, 2016. Every project then, really, we've had a ramp. So we've kind of used the customers to load test the site for us and then frantically ran around for 2 weeks, desperately adding more instances until the graph goes green again. But you can't always do that. What kind of project were you working on where you were thinking, wow, we really need to make sure this works before anyone else sees it?
Yeah, true. Like, it's not essential to do load testing each and every feature you ship, but at times you might be releasing some feature that would be used by a lot of users. Like you have been doing some phase rollout, and now you think that this is the good time to release this to all the users. And like before releasing that, you need to be like sure that the application performs well at that point. So that was one use case where I had to do this load testing. And the other point where I had to do load testing was we were sure that there were a few new clients coming on, and those were like very big clients which would like increase the load to our application. We knew that prior because of the sales pipeline that we predicted those things.
So you knew you were going to get hit.
Yeah. Like there are times you know that you are going to get hit, but there are times you don't know you are going to be hit. I think the point where you need to be prepared, where you don't know where you are going to be hit, is those areas of the application that are like most critical for you, which must perform on any point. So at that point, you do those load testing there. But when you know that, like, there are some times when you know that the more users are coming in, then it's a must to do the testing of the server and figure out, like, if you know the number, how many users that are coming in, that's even better. If you don't know, we can do stress tests and figure out, like, what's the breaking point of the application.
Now, I'm going to ask you a loaded question here, because you make a really good point in the article that performance testing is not the same as a load testing. So Rails has a few performance test tools built into it. Why wouldn't you just use those built-in Rails performance tests? Why go to the trouble of learning how to use the JMeter system?
That's a very good question. Rails provides this very, very nice internal tool to do performance tests, and I would recommend you to use that to test your server, how is going on. But what performance test does is like smaller version of load test. Like it helps you figure out how much time it's using, how much resources it's using based on a single user request, or limited you to a single user machine. And you can't like really simulate actual real world scenario where thousands of users are concurrently using your application, and what happens how does your server react? Not only the code, but how does your infrastructure react? Does it auto scale, or does it auto scale on time, or how much a user would have to get error before auto scale happens? So those kind of questions answer you'd get from load testing, whereas from performance testing you'd be able to get how much time does this function take to execute, or how much time does this API take to respond. Those kind of answers you can get from performance testing.
This is really cool. My experience load testing is strictly just with Apache's Bench, you know, the AB tool. Go and dump a ton of requests at a very specific endpoint. I really
it's a
like
dangerous tool.
Yeah, very it's a dangerous tool. AB. I really like how you outlined with what JMeter can do as far as configuration, and definitely the distributed portion of that testing is pretty incredible. Do you want to talk about maybe some issues you ran into getting that to work? I just picture auth, you know, the authentication system in trying to get this to work in general. Just even with AB tool is hard enough. Adding an extra layer of distribution, you know, what kind of issues did you run into that?
Yeah, like a normal load testing without a distributed server would be like not that difficult. But while you are making distributed, you might like there are a few challenges that can come across. I think the main point here would be to understand the basic concept of distributed testing. If that concept is in mind, it would be easier to like make that set up. But like if there are a few core things that you don't have like understanding of, then we can run into problem. That's what I had. Like I didn't have prior like proper mechanism to understand how distributed testing works. So I first read about those distributed testing, how like multiple infrastructures are needed and the basic core concepts. So after that, it was easier for me to follow up the Apache JMeter's mechanism to do the distributed testing. So I'd like to talk a few things about what are the other challenges that I faced during that. Like during distributed testing, there's basically one main server that commands the other servers to do the load testing, and one is the commander that tells the other servers to make this mess request from this IP to this user and make these parallel requests this setup. So there's a sync mechanism that needs to be present between the master. I wouldn't say master right now because it's the main server and the testing server. So there needs to be a certificate making thing that needs to be set up between those two so that it knows that the request is coming from the main server to do the load test. So those kind of setups were a little challenging. Those things were initially challenging because the certificate setup would require you to copy the certificate from the main server to other distributed servers. And
did you use any automated tools or anything to kind of help along with the configuration process? Because it sounds like very intensive configuration process for setting this all up.
Yeah, like JMeter already provides you a configuration setup for the distributed testing, so that can be used to set up the distributed testing mechanism.
Like if you wanted to make changes to that later, is that easy enough to just jump into the configuration, or is there a tool like Chef or something like that that would help kind of keep track of that in a longer term?
Yeah, that can. A tool like Chef would be required. Like the configuration, like input to the test needs to be uploaded to all the distributed servers, because the distributed service needs to read those things from the file. It can be a CSV file where different configurations are placed. So an automation mechanism is like really essential there, because you don't want to go into each machine and change all the configuration there. So that would be like very difficult. If you have just few servers, it would be okay, but in load testing, what we want is to have multiple machines and all those distributed machines to work parallelly. So an automation mechanism is a must there. Yeah.
So, it has been quite a while since I have had the motivation to do some load testing or whatever, and it's going to happen again. You kind of talked about like the tools and things like that. Did you find any tutorials that made it like easier to kind of like get this running faster or anything like that?
Yeah, like
kind of doing this.
I followed the. I was trying to follow the official document of JMeter, and it was like all distributed among different documents, and it was not like sequentially step by step. Like, what's the first step do we need to do? What are the basic concept of Apache JMeters, and how do you do it from your own local machine, not machine first, and try it out, learn basic things about Apache JMeter, and then slowly, gradually move to distributed testing, and also not only distributed testing, but also having that mechanism where you can like actually record the user behavior and simulate that user behavior via the load testing tool. So that way you would be like able to really make that production like thing in your load test environment. Like you can't predict what user behavior it is, but so user behavior can't be like written down in script and trying to predict like the user would do this. But instead of that, like really going to the browser and figuring out how users users actually interact with your app, and recording that interaction and being able to clear that interaction, that would, so that are some of the mechanism. And so I was trying to figure out search all these things, and they were like distributed on different blocks. So I was writing these all these things in my note while I was doing this load testing, and like writing everything in one note. And I decided to like, okay, so this is a good note. I published this as a blog post. So I wrote down from the first step to actually going to distribute it. That's one blog that I have written about which covers from the starting, how you can get started to the like big, large level, large, high scale load testing.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like there's possibly some room to help people get from zero to working, but awesome. So then my other question that I had for you specifically on this was, so you guys did this load testing stuff. What kinds of, did you find like some interesting surprises? I know that Valentina was asking if you maybe like ran into some like hiccups if you were trying to like get it started up, but did you find out that your app like totally breaks at like 1,000 users and you weren't ready for it or anything like weird like that?
Yeah, we were able to figure out a few of the issues in our application. Initially, we thought, we were assuming that we are ready for this much number of users, and we were like sure, okay, this is sure would work and would not break, and we were targeting a higher number. That was like we were trying to load test, but we figured it out that the problem was like prior to reaching that higher number, and like it was very surprising for us, like for us to figure out that the issue was there. And another surprising thing that we found out was we were trying to load test one of our key functionalities that was like very key to our core business logic. But to reach that point, the user first needs to log into our application, and we never thought that login would have any performance issue or anything issue there. But like doing that load test, we figured out that user would be like stuck in the login process itself before going to that phase. So that was like really surprising for us. And like it was a good thing as well. We were able to figure out that issue.
Yeah, I remember I've totally had an app where login actually. I mean, it's been a long time or whatever, but I remember having an app in the early days of Rails where we were actually I think we were like marshaling data to like a table. It just like user login just like totally got hung up on that or whatever. I'm also thinking like, I think some of the interesting things that you can find during load balancing, like my favorite one is, so this is actually the same app at a completely different time in its life, but we were broadcasting video and we were using flash servers and things like this. So, you know, we didn't even think about the fact that like we suddenly started offering the ability for users to also provide pictures. So we were doing auctions or whatever, and most of the time we just broadcast video, but then we started like providing like pictures and things for various things. And one thing that we just weren't expecting was, well, if we like switched basically the thing that was being auctioned, then everybody starts downloading an image at the same time, right? Well, yeah. So we hadn't really thought through and even considered like the fact that like when you have a lot of people all trying to download the image at the same time, that's a lot of requests to your web server all of a sudden for images, right? And we were using Apache at the time. This was before like everybody had really kind of like, this is like 15 years ago. This is like before everyone, almost 15 years ago. This is before everyone had kind of like really jumped on the Nginx train and Nginx. This is one of the reasons why we did, is because that helped us with that a little bit. But, you know, eventually we like got a CDN, which like was like better even then, you know. But yeah, I mean, there, you can totally be surprised by the things you're just not like necessarily thinking of, you know, because like I said, we were broadcasting video. We were like, images, that's like less bandwidth than video. It'll just be easy. We just like blew past it. Didn't even think about implications. Mm-hmm. And yeah, boom, auction day came, you know, and bad stuff happened. So anyway, yeah, load testing is pretty sweet. I mean, that motivated us to do like a lot of load testing throughout of our app for lots of things after that point.
Yeah, true. Like we usually know that some of our users are coming and we know that there are performance issues in certain part of the application and we try to optimize it without load testing. And what happens is that we optimize that part and we send it to production and we think like everything is good, but there are like really unexpected places where things get break down and we would never be able to figure it out without like actually simulating the real users load in before going to the production.
So that actually prompts another question, which is, do you ever find yourself trying to optimize stuff before you load test, or do you load test then try to optimize something and then load test to confirm that you actually like made something faster?
I really love this question because load testing can be difficult and it takes time to test functionality. So we are releasing a new feature and you wouldn't want to load test all of your functionalities, like it would really slow down. And if you have like a lot of developers and a lot of things, features you are releasing, then load testing can slow you down. So instead of load testing all the features, what I recommend is to do performance test of each of the feature. Like that's the essential part, because before releasing, if you could do performance tests of even your functions or if your controllers or your models, you can know like what happens when a single user requests. So is the response time like good enough? Having a benchmark for each of your each of your controllers, each of your routes would help you like figure out if it needs to do load test or not. Like suppose there is a 300 millisecond or 200 ms of like baseline that you have set for each API endpoints. So testing that performance, if it's within that 300 ms or not. If it's not, then you optimize and push to production only if it's up to that threshold limit. So that's, I think, something that is that doesn't take much time and is easier to do. So I recommend that doing in every functionality or feature before releasing production. But like load testing is something that helps you figure out a larger scale problem. So optimizing, there are different kinds of optimization that would be required for the outcome from load testing, and a different kind of optimization that would be required from performance testing. So I usually do performance testing and optimize and then release the functionality. Whereas I release some functionality and if the load testing only on weekly basis or monthly basis as a whole package and optimize later as based on the outcome of that.
Okay, so maybe to transition a little bit too. So as you were talking, I kind of was thinking about something and this seemed like an interesting opportunity. So one of the things that we often do in Ruby is we say, huh, this thing is running slow. Let me just like go put it in Sidekick, right? Well, but then I'm still probably like running Ruby code and things
so
like
true.
That.
It's slow. Give it more code, and Redis just add more things until it gets fast.
Yeah. But at the same time, that doesn't necessarily fix my problem, right? Like I'm really, what you're really doing when you're throwing it on Sidekick, right, is you're just throwing more hardware at it, right? You're separating your hardware, putting on something else. But one of the things that I know that I've advocated and done over the years is, okay, this thing runs really slow in Ruby. Let me just like shell out other stuff. And we talked about it at the very beginning of the episode that you do some like Golang. Do you find yourself like being like, all right, I got this thing in Sidekick or a Rescue or whatever you're using. Let me shell out to another language. Golang is a potential choice, but there's others as well. Are there things that you do? Do you integrate stuff? Do you have other ways of integrating other languages with Rails, or do you keep all that stuff kind of separate?
Yeah, like I do Rails and Go with the same application. I wouldn't say the same application, but different microservices that would communicate via event or gRPC and different stuff. So yeah, like Go is faster compared to Ruby, and it takes less memory and it's like more resource sensitive. It's not that resource intensive as Ruby. And the most powerful thing about Go is have the concurrency, the power of concurrency, which in Ruby, the concurrency, we need to rely on things like Sidekick or Rescue and the tools. But Go has a better concurrency mechanism. So usually based on the use case and any concurrent requests or those things that needs to handle, so I moved to like a different Go microservice which the Rails would communicate via events, and the things happens there. Yeah, like talking about the Sidekick, moving everything to Sidekick is a very 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 bad choice. But like having a better architecture and being able to figure out like the domain of the application, and based on domain, which domain needs some concurrent processing or reporting and those kind of things, use case, splitting out to a microservice and letting Go do the stuffs there where Ruby is not that good.
Gotcha. So it sounds like your architectural choice isn't to mix in Go or something else with your Ruby app, but to kind of have a separate app over here and have them act as, you know, in some sort of microservice type relationship. I don't know who is, you know, who is doing what role or whatever, but it sounds like you're just like splitting them out into separate apps. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I have seen people also doing integrating Go and instead of Sidekick, doing that via Go and running that via Go, but like I like doing it in a different microservice and not mixing Ruby and Go together in the same place.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, heck, there's a wide variety, right, of architecture choices all along the spectrum that you can pick.
Makes me wonder if maybe load testing is a good way to identify, you know, where to isolate things in your domain. Like should this particular service be moved to a different microservice, like you're saying? Do you ever use load testing to identify those things?
I haven't used load testing to identify that kind of thing, but I think that's a good use case as well to figure things out. Like only load testing would not be enough to figure that out, I guess. Like monitoring tools and performance tracking tools are also essential when you are doing load tests. So usually when you do load tests, the tools like Apache and JMeter gives you a report of how the performance is. But you'd also want to know like how your instances of performing, like how much CPU it's using, or like what's is it over consuming or burning this CPU, having that like monitoring tool is also like very very essential there, and so those tools would like help to break down like what are the loose points and what are the points where the application is not performing well, and maybe also help to figure out like if this needs a different microservice to handle this kind of work, and like if there are one kind of application, one kind of use case that is slow, but the other kind of use case that is very fast, but the slow kind of use case is like causing the performance issue in the other part, which is crucial for your application to run. But like things like reporting, the reporting is on your same application, and the user's main transactional thing is also happening in the same place. And like load test helps you, or performance tests would help you to figure out like these two things needs to be. So this slow part is making your fast application slow as well. So it will help to split down. Okay, you can just split down from here. Don't let the slow part make your good application, which is essential, to slow down as well.
So this is all about building a giant cannon. This is why I think about it. You're creating a giant cannon that you can fire at your website and then watch it explode. Am I right?
Yeah, that's the way to think.
And the J meter, what the advantage of J meter above the AB that Valentin you were talking about, when I did it, I used to have to create 10 AWS EC2 instances and then coordinate AB just using a load of shell tabs, just kind of switching between them and hitting run and then kind of watching the server go offline. But the idea behind the JMeter is that it kind of does that for you in a more organized way. Am I right?
Yeah, that's true.
Is it spinning up instances itself? Can it, like, if you give it a, like an AWS key, can it go and create its own instances?
No, it doesn't create AWS instances itself, because JMeter is not like aware of AWS or any cloud tool, but it's like developed for generic multi-server purpose, which can be used on cloud or which can be used on-premise as well. So the setup part of having multiple instances should be handled separately. But once you have that instance and things set up done, the rest thing is handled by JMeter, as there's one server that is the controller server, which would control all the other servers' requests, and you basically like write a JMX file, which is the load testing file where you specify how much trades do you want to run concurrently, or how much at what ramp up period you want the test to run, and basically add that script in the instances that you want to run it from, and execute the, you give one single command and the rest of the thing will be handled by JMeter, and it'll automatically do the concurrent requests. There are different reports that would be generated from different distributed servers, so bringing that report together and giving you a single report, so everything that would be handled by JMeter, so in a more organized way.
Are you under increasing pressure to ship code faster than ever before? Then it's time to work smarter with Raygun's modern approach to error and performance monitoring. Raygun gives you instant visibility into the health of your software, and what makes it so unique is that it not only tells you when something's gone wrong, it shows you exactly where it's gone wrong and how to fix it, right down to the line of code. Made by developers for developers, Raygun has built a suite of monitoring tools that are used and loved by thousands of software teams every day. Monitor every corner of your tech stack with widespread language support and native integrations with GitHub, Jira, Slack, Bitbucket, Octopus Deploy, and more for even greater visibility. Visit raygun.com to resolve issues faster and deliver flawless digital experiences for your users. That's raygun.com to get started on your free 14-day trial with plans starting from as little as $4 per month.
And the other thing, of course, about testing is closing the loop. I want to refer to a thing that I called FEF. Where it stands for front-end fakery with an A. Front-end fakery. I don't always call it that, but we'll abbreviate that to FEF. And this is the idea that with something like a React front-end, something like a whole load of sidekick jobs running in the background, you can do load testing on your Rails app and everything looks okay, but the site is operationally broken. So although the page is loading and your metrics look good, the users can't actually do their job. And this is, of course, the problem we had with React which is absolutely terrible for this. React will look like it's working when it's not. And we had a situation on the e-commerce site where, yeah, we did loads of, I think we used Selenium. Do you use Selenium for testing? This is the thing that actually clicks around the web page, so it kind of loads up a virtual Chrome. We had loads of that, and it was kind of going around clicking everything. But the customer experience was totally broken because it wasn't actually loading a customer's images. It was just kind of putting a whole load of HTML down. So how apart from looking at the actual, you know, site metrics, site response, do you have any kind of closed loop testing you can do where you can kind of validate the output from the server?
Yeah, that actually, from in JMeter, what happens is, like, suppose you are using a web browser. And what a web browser does is basically the job of a web browser is to store cookie or store sessions, and based on that it makes call to your backend to the backend server and render that in front end page. So that's what it does, right? So we can like actually sit with that on JMeter. Be like similar to what browser does, it stores the cookie, so you can store the cookie there, and so the session information, and based on that session cookie you can like make the request on behalf of the user, like even the login, when the user logs in, the session would be there and save the session there and make a request, and it would like response back in the same format. So the response can be from server, can be a HTML or text based response, or it can be a JSON response as well. So there are post processor things that JMeter has. So post-processor are basically when after you make a request, the response can be processed. And based on that process response, we can also write assertion on top of that. So assertion would help validate like if the response is actually what we want the user to see, or is there something else that's the user is being there to see. But like, these kind of basic things can be done in with JMeter, parse the HTML and see if there is the actual content there or not, and it's actually rendering some images or not, or it's rendering actual text or not. So those kind of tests can be done, but still it's not like 100% assured. I wouldn't say like 100% sure to make sure that okay, user would see this 100%, but since all the template might be tested or might not be there, so it could be the same or it could be different. I think the one other way is to do snapshot testing. I think you guys have heard about snapshot testing.
I've not heard of snapshot. What is a snapshot test?
So snapshot test basically takes a snapshot of your HTML page or your content that is rendered, and you can test against that snapshot on some other time. Like you deploy some of the features and test if the snapshot matches the old snapshot that you have taken. So that matches, and if there's anything different there, then it would report like, okay, the snapshot doesn't match here. And that way also you can figure out, like, it's most useful when new features are being released, and if it's if that feature is breaking user experience or not.
See, and the reason I talk about this is because I've been burned by this before. This is what caught me out big time the last time. So the idea is that the JMeter is going to be able to send a lot more requests per second for a given infrastructure, because it's not running web browser. It's kind of recording the gets and the posts and the puts, and it's kind of replaying those. So if you wanted to run 10,000 users on a single machine, you can do that because it doesn't have overhead. It's just sending the raw requests, right?
Yeah.
But the problem I've had, especially with React, I mean, I'm going to say it again, React, is that I've had situations where the page has loaded and the Rails bit is happy, but there's something in the JavaScript that is then kicking off some kind of enormous Rails query. and then all of my pages say they're loading in 400 milliseconds, but it's actually 6 seconds until the user gets something on screen. Is that a challenge you had, or do you just not use React like all sensible people?
Yeah, I use React, so it's like when
I'm joking. Don't send me emails about React.
I think everyone uses React. Is like there's like 99% React. yeah. So what I
react to your comment about React.
Oh, very meta.
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, you can have, if you only test the Rails portion of your stuff, Luke, and then you don't test any of the React stuff, then of course, yeah, React can break your page.
Never miss the opportunity to kick JavaScript when it's down.
Luke's just giving React a hard time. It's not a serious question.
Yeah, okay. But no, you can see what I'm getting at here. The JVs looks really great for testing. It's testing the actual Rails bit. But, you know, Rails isn't what lets me down. My experience is it's never Rails that lets you down. It's something else. It's something that's not in the Rails.
In all fairness, I think if you test the wrong thing, or if you don't test the thing that you care about, right? Then that's what's going to happen to you, right? Like you if you are worried that something's going to break your app, like test for that thing.
Yeah, and like it's not just while load testing, it's not just Rails you'd load test, but also React. I like it can be tested from React as well, because usually what happens when you are having React is like it does most of the call asynchronous. And In Rails, what we usually tend to do is have the controller and view render the pages or
yep.
things like that. But like in case of React, the page comes in and it fetches the data asynchronously and then renders the things there. And if user clicks something, then it states a change and it again calls those endpoints and get the fetches data and re-renders the page, right? So what cannot be tested while during load testing is like the rendering part of in the browser, I guess. Like the rendering part is can be tricky because when the data is already here and if React takes time to render the page and you have a lot of state changes going on there. So that kind of thing can be like really difficult to test. But what can still be tested something is having that asynchronous call. Like if something is clicked, the state is changed and the React makes call to the data and fetch the data. Up to fetching the data can be tested, but like how the browser behaves after that rendering is very difficult to test and can cause problems.
So on the topic of comparisons, I see you mentioned Puma versus Unicorn, and clearly Puma wins.
Puma does win. That's the correct answer.
Yeah. Can you explain maybe, because you do leave a footnote here on that there are trade-offs when one works better than the other. Can you shed some quick light onto times where you found one works better than the other?
Yeah, like I think it depends upon what kind of application that you have. Some applications might be resource sensitive. Like some applications can take higher memories, but like some needs higher CPU, right? So there are different kind of application that you have. Based on that, I think the choose between Unicorn and Puma can be determined. But like I wouldn't say like if you have higher memory, go for Puma, or if you have higher CPU, go for Unicorn. That's not like straightforward answer. But like in general, I'd say like Puma is like very better for general use cases. But like actually you have to test your application out to figure it out, like what is best for you, is Unicorn or is it Puma, because the application, each application has different kind of behavior. Like some endpoints takes higher memory and some are you are running there are like thousands of requests concurrently happening in your servers, and some of your requests are memory intensive, some of your requests are CPU intensive, right? So based on that, like the performance can be different if based like if you're using Unicorn or if you're using Fuma. So doing one level of testing would like really easily help you figure out, okay, this is good for my application and I need to use this.
So in general, use Puma like you would in general use Rails.
Yeah.
I like Puma. It works. I never liked Unicorn. I don't know why. I think it's the name. I don't like the... Yeah, it's like a kind of magic, mysterious, magical thing. The Puma, because I got cats, right? You know, I've got cats, so I can get on board with a Puma. The Unicorns... You know, it's like keeping a pony. Costs are going to rack up.
I don't know. Puma has that hipster kind of connotation, right? With the sneakers and...
Well, no, not in Europe, because Puma's like a German brand, yeah? So that's just like a kind of normal thing over here.
Jeez. I mean, I was just thinking about to when... I mean, Unicorn just didn't really have a long time on its own, right? Like Puma came out really fast after Unicorn, I feel like. Within maybe it was a couple years, but I didn't really think it had like a long time. And Unicorn, being from the thin family, has all the problems that all the rest of the thin family has, you know. So I don't know, we've had thin for a while, so I don't know. I always felt like Unicorn really to me just is like thin too, and so like I'm used to thin, we've had it since forever. I don't know, I like everything that's not thin, so you know, I don't know that I've ever given Unicorn much of a fair shake. I did use it for like half a year to a year, I think, on like a couple projects. And then I was like, huh, Puma's better. Let's just go. And then I left it behind.
Yeah, I mean, I used to run Fin, I'm sure, probably like you, for async events. So if you do a lot of async and for a while, and Fin was what you used, and it let me down. When I was doing, I needed more control over the rack side of things. So I was doing things like service end events and long polling. Long polling was what I found it. I just couldn't make it work on Fin, jumped to Puma and never looked back. But I still have a Unicorn server in production today. I know, because it broke.
That's fair. All right. Did we have any? Did we miss anything? Or is there anything else?
Yeah, I want to just briefly touch on the AWS Lambda and Ruby, because you know you've done your load testing, you've built your enormous Jamie to Canon, you've fired it at your website, it's blown into 1,000 pieces, and now you're sitting there thinking, well, I don't want that to happen when the customers come along. I want to make a good first impression when they first see the website and it launches. I want everything to work beautifully. So I believe you've been using the AWS Lambda, which I've never seen in production. I believe this is more of a kind of JavaScript community thing. I've never seen a production AWS Lambda setup with Ruby. So I'd be really interested in hearing how and why you got on with that.
Yeah, we have. I have been using AWS Lambda for basically... mostly for asynchronous processing and like queue-based processing, usually like, so let's say...
this would replace Sidekick in your app, right?
Yeah, it can be replaced for Sidekick. Like only Lambda would not be able to replace Sidekick completely, because Lambda is just a processing server which processes some of the function that provides, but you would not have that queue mechanism that Sidekick has. Sidekick provides like you based on the queue, and you can process the queue have retries and all those mechanisms. So you can push everything to Sidekick from... Instead of pushing to Sidekick, push it to Lambda, and Lambda will do the processing and do the stuff. So here, what another advantage is that if you want to not use Ruby in your asynchronous processing and use Go instead, then push it to Lambda and run in the Go. But what we need in one more thing that would need in between the Lambda and Rails is a queue. So if you push directly, then there would be like all concurrent, all of those would be process parallelly and concurrently, which we would want some concurrency, but not a lot. We want some control in concurrency. Also, we want some queuing mechanism. So for that, we can use a different queuing mechanism like SQS or any other queuing tools in between and processor, like use actually with the as an ecosystem within Rails, like extending the Rails to like more of serverless mechanism in the background.
So I'm so glad you mentioned the word serverless. So this is the idea, I think, that instead of having, say, 10 servers there, then when a request comes in for, say, my app / get photos, then that something spins up in the cloud that's not a complete server. So on demand, when one of those requests comes in, then instead of having a server sitting there waiting, it just kind of runs enough code to handle that one request. Am I right?
Yeah, that's true. Like there's no server already running there waiting for a request to come. But instead, like when the request comes, there's something pops up in the cloud and processes your request and again goes down and waits and like, yeah, that cycle is finished. And when another request comes, another thing will pop up and process request and go down. So that's like a very, very cost optimized when you have use cases where there are a lot of users active in certain hours and there are zero users active in certain hours. So you don't want to like pay a lot of money when there's no users around, and you don't want the server to go down when there are a lot of users coming in. So that kind of balance it provides. Like if there's a lot of spike in users, it all handles itself, and we don't need to like worry about, oh, where's my is my application server capable of scaling? Would it handle a lot of users or not? So it would all be handled by the serverless mechanism, and also have you saves cost when there's no user.
How has this been a positive experience? Well, what I want to get to is do you recommend people use Lambdas with Rails, or is this something which you'd only do if you really, really needed to optimize costs?
Yeah, I would. I have seen positive things when using Lambda, so I would recommend using Lambdas. Basically, if you are having scaling issues in your asynchronous processing mechanism, so at that time Lambda would be useful. But Lambda is also a server, like it's serverless, but it is server. It is some kind of resource there up in server that's not visible to us and managed completely by cloud providers. But that doesn't mean that we write code that is super slow and it's not optimized and try to like, okay, now this is problem with Sidekick and I push it to AWS Lambda to solve the problem. So that's not a good thing to do way, because you're just your application is code or is not optimized well, but just changing that place where it runs the code would not like solve the problem. But like it would solve the problem for use cases like I mentioned previously, like when you have surge of requests and when you have no request. So at this point of time, it would be helpful. Is that a serverless?
So for the benefit viewer listening at home, I have just walked across to my bed and picked up a one new Dell server, because I'm never more than 3 feet away from a server. And because I did a lot of systems administration, did a lot of Linux before I got into Ruby programming, I feel like the server is my friend. So generally, I associate servers and dealing with them as a kind of positive experience, something I can do. I'm well aware that the vast majority of software developers do not feel this way. And the server is only talked about when the next two words are "is down." So generally, when you hear about servers, when you're doing the developing, servers are down. That's when you hear about the servers, is when there's a problem with them. Am I right?
There's like, some amount of
like
truth to that.
Everything is like being handled by cloud provider, and like the developers are being completely disattached with the servers. But it's like really essential to understand the servers. Like, I really like the server that you have holding.
Right. This server is my friend. I have positive feelings about server. I respect that this is a very, very non-mainstream feeling in the Rails community. The server is generally not your friend, especially if you've been around Rails for a while. And you were around about 10 years ago when everything was running out of RAM. Getting enough RAM in these machines is a real challenge. Now you can get a server with 200 gig of RAM, like, easy. You know, it's not even hard to get that. So the great Rails RAM crisis of 2011 has since passed. But, you know, I feel like server's my friend. When someone says a technology is serverless, I'm like, why are you taking my servers away? You know, I know where I am with my server. But I think this is very much the way things are going. A couple of more recent projects have been using Lambdas or similar technology. So really interesting to hear your perspective on it, because I think it's definitely the way things are going.
It's been a while since I've touched AWS Lambda with Ruby. But last I checked, they had some startup costs involved with using Ruby. Did you have any experience with that when you were playing with it recently?
Yeah, Lambdas can trigger some extra cost if you're not conscious. Like, sometimes it doesn't have a limit of how much it can go up. And sometimes you might be triggering Lambdas a lot and you might not be aware, and it causes like a lot of bills to go up. Yeah, like I had faced a few issues like that previously. One issue was not related to like lot of requests going there and increasing the cost, but like the code that I had written in Lambda was making a request to external service, and the external service was slowing down. So the Lambda had to wait till the external service respond, right? And because of that time, I had to wait. I had to pay for that wait time as well. So it was like increasing my cost because the performance was slow. And
let's not ignore the fact that the day we're recording this on is the day that Jeff Bezos has built himself an enormous rocket and launched himself into space for a laugh. So, you know, just feel reassured that all your AWS money is going to a good cause.
I mean, you do make a good point, though, in that, you know, it seems a good way to put important processes in, because you're not going to want to pay for them while they're broken. And maybe putting processes that are sensitive to, you know, some of these performance bottlenecks can be best treated if you're immediately paying for them.
So there we are. AWS Lambda
will make you have to fix them faster.
Is officially the swear jar of the Ruby on Rails development community. Use it if you feel like punishing yourself with money.
Wow.
Only joking. It's the future. Yes, it is.
I don't disagree that like you kind of got to learn this stuff, right? But at the same time, like, I think it's also important to be cognizant that Lambda, like anything else, is an architectural choice, right? And so you are going to have to make decisions now and, you know, for the entire rest of your career about whether it's right for this project or not, right? Like, is the transitional cost like worth the headache, you know, is the headache of switching like worth it, or I'm starting this new project? There's lots of things you have to think about. And just like any architecture, sometimes it's not going to be the right choice. And, you know, I mean, we all love to sit here and laugh at the person that's a complete moron because they made the really stupid architectural choice that we're sitting here from our white towers. And we think that you're an idiot for making that choice. But there, at the end of the day, you live with the consequences of the architectural choices you make. So, you know, be sure that you are happy with what you choose, I guess, right? Lambda or not.
Yeah. Milap has an excellent article on the Honey Badge blog about building, testing, deploying AWS Lambda functions in Ruby. So I highly recommend you check that out.
Cool. I think it's pick time.
I think it is pick time, John. You beat me to the punch. I think it's pick time.
Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
Who should I could pick someone to pick picks first instead of me? Valentino, what are your picks?
Sure, thank you. I guess the first one I had is a talk by one of my coworkers, Austin Story. He gave at RailsConf, and again, recently at Sardines RB, I think. It's called Effective Data Synchronization Between Rails Microservices. Talks about a lot of the underlying data architecture that we have built at Doximity. And it's a really great talk on using Kafka as kind of a messaging synchronization queue. Highly recommend it. And on the topic of AWS Lambda, there are two projects that I found researching this that I thought were kind of cool. One is called Yake. It's a kind of Rake-like handler for managing AWS Lambda functions with Ruby. Seemed pretty promising. And for our talks about background processing with Ruby, you can apparently use a special queue called Lambda Punch to send a lot of those background processing jobs to AWS Lambda and see how much you have to pay for using AWS over maybe something more simple.
Great. John, what are your picks?
So I have a couple picks. One is an article. So I think like many senior developers, I hold a lot of different opinions. And over the course of the years, I have found that a number of my opinions are in conflict with Jason Sweats or whatever, who we all know and love in this Ruby community or whatever. And that's fine. Like, I think that's okay. I mean, obviously they're my opinions. Of course, I think they're fine. But I was catching up on some articles that I had like been like, oh, I'm going to read that later or whatever, right? Like, so I do try to spend some time reading articles every week from Ruby Weekly. But sometimes there are so many articles on Ruby Weekly that I want to read that week. And I run out of time, and then it's just like, you know, stuff happens and I don't get them till later. So I'm actually catching up on an article, I think, from like 4 or 5 Ruby Weeklies ago. And I was reading this article yesterday, and I was like, this is a good article. And it's by Jason Sweat, and you should read it. But it's titled, Which Test Framework Should I Learn? RSpec or Minitest? It's also about a thing that we have in this Ruby community where people hold a lot of very strong opinions one way or the other, right? And I even hold my own. And I thought that Jason
Sweat... What is your opinion, John?
Like, the very first point that Jason Sweat makes in this entire thing is usually someone else decides for you. And I think that's the most important thing. Like, you come into an app, right? And it's got a testing framework. It's just let the argument go. Like, it's just not time to argue. Like, no one really wants to rewrite all of the tests from one framework into another. It's just an absolute pain in the butt. Like, just don't. But I mean, look, if you personally want to know my opinion, I think that the existence of RSpec Minitest tells you everything that you need to know. The fact that everyone was like, huh, I don't like Minitest enough that I'm going to make it look like RSpec tells you RSpec has a crap ton of problems, first of all. Like, I understand that, right? But like, at the end of the day, like, we like how RSpec looks. It, like, there's a certain amount of us, I think, that like writing tests, but I think that's a very, very small subset of us. Most of us, we believe in testing, but we actually don't like being in testing land. We go into the dark place and we try to get out of there as soon as we can. And I think that RSpec is a fantastic tool to help us get out quickly, right? Like, that's how I look at it. I think that people like it. And I think the reason why they like it is because it's easy to read. And I know that even though my fellow programmers are going to write terrible RSpec tests, and I know that I'm going to have to go in there and like fix up some of that junk that they put in there, at least they're writing tests. And I feel like when I get to mini tests, my teammates are like literally dodging writing tests because they're just having such a hard time writing tests, right? that's how I feel. So I feel like I would much rather the people on my team that hate testing the most write some dodgy RSpec tests that I have to fix than me have to write more tests from scratch to cover for that. That's how I feel about it. But anyway, it's a good article and he talks through some of those things. That's why I feel about it. But I thought that it was really good. So anyway, so that's one pick. My second one that I'm going to pick again, I know that I've picked this before, but I had a great experience recently with Monoprice. They need to like give us a sponsorship or something because I think I've picked them like 3 times now.
With who, sorry?
Monoprice. I like buying their cables and stuff because one of the big problems that I have, like whenever I buy cables from anywhere else, is like cables or chargers or things like that, right? Is I get them and something's not right. It could be any number of things, right? Like maybe my phone's drawing too much power or whatever, but like I didn't know that when I was buying the freaking cable. Like there's a lot of things to track, and I just happen to like the, like I'm getting like good stuff from them and I know it's good stuff and my stuff isn't gonna break. That's my thoughts on that. So I got, those are my picks.
Listen, John, the smallest test, the miniest test, is the test you do not write.
That is a true statement, but full of crap.
Speaking of which, onto my picks. First pick is an article by Chandan Kumar, a couple of years old for Geek Flare, where he talks about securing the Apache HTTP server. I've had some downtime this week, and I'm not talking about R&R. I'm talking about my production servers. And I spent a lot of time in my log files and noticed some naughty requests coming in from some opportunistic hackers. When I run SSH on servers, then I have a thing called SSH guard that automatically bans people who don't belong. But I don't have that same capability in my web servers. So I wanted to add a kind of auto ban feature where if someone's doing suspicious things on my website, they just get a kind of cooling off period. They can kind of go into timeout for 20 minutes and then they can come back and make another request. So that's a really good guide to setting that sort of proactive security thing up. You can hilariously break your Rails apps using one of the features which reduces the maximum allowable, and they're called magic characters. So things like question marks and colons and quotes, the number of magic characters allowed in all your web requests. So if someone's got a form and they kind of type in a whole load of punctuation, they can kind of basically be banned by a website. Something to watch out for, but a nevertheless great security guide. And my second pick, which I wasn't going to make, but John, since you brought it up, is Dave Thomas of the Agile Manifesto fame and Pragmatic Programmer giving a talk in 2015 where he tells everyone he doesn't write tests anymore. I'm paraphrasing, it's a great talk. Agile is dead. Put a link in the show notes. Mylap, what are your picks?
So I'll go with the picks. The first one is I've been learning more about Go language. So I'd been using a different...
It's not allowed. You can't pick another language on the Ruby Rogues podcast. This is scandalous. This is picking... Sorry, please go on. You're picking the Go language or something specific on it?
Yeah, like this is for someone who...
I'm going to pick JavaScript next time, Luke.
JavaScript, yeah. Okay, so for Go, I was like learning few of the Go language, and this one best place to learn Go, that's like GoForksize, where you can like build projects and watch videos and learn. So I've been using that to learn like different tricks and tools of Go, and basically like trying to upgrade my skills from there. And it's like very, though I like the way he teaches the language, the video, and the way he speaks, and it's free, so that's why like it's free and for community, and like it's learning is very great to learn from there. So I learned a lot from here. So I like to recommend for people who are like interested to learn Go. So my second pick at Go is a site that I like usually open while I'm coding, and it it basically plays me lo-fi music. I really enjoy listening to lo-fi music and like coding. I like where I'm when I'm just coding, like listening to this lo-fi music would like give me like really like gives me like energy boost to code. So I use it during my coding session. Like there are different lo-fi music that you can customize and listen to. Like instead of playing that in YouTube, like it's playing in that side is like really interactive and real fun.
Very cool. If people want to contact you, find out about more, where should they go?
About, you mean the big?
On Twitter or to read more of your blog posts, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to Twitter and my ID is _MILAP_MILAP. So yeah, I usually post at Twitter, and also you can go to my blog, my personal blog, that's milapneopane.com.np, where I write my personal blogs there.
That's brilliant. Well, that's all from us this time on the Ruby Rose podcast. As always, go and check out devchat.tv for more outrageous programming content. Thanks to our panelists, Valentino, John Emerson, and thanks to MILAP. Really interesting to get up to date on talks because the scale of the internet's just getting bigger and bigger, and knowing how to load up 10,000, 100,000 users at the same time just kind of quickly give you peace of mind more than anything else, that when you launch your Rails site, it's not going to horribly explode into a cloud of SQL. It's really useful. So thank you very much. Until next time, it's Luke out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.